credit scores, down payments, interest rates. Car buying can be a numbers game, but you don't have to be a math expert to get the keys to your dream car. Just use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. Crunch your numbers and get personalized results so you know exactly how much you'll pay each month for your car. It's like having a magic wand for your wallet. Presto! The car you've been wanting is now within reach. So hit the road and leave your calculator at home. Auto Trader.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everybody, it's me, Josh, and my pick for SYSK Selects this week is the one we did on the 10,000-year clock. Just looking back, I think it's probably one of the coolest episodes we've ever done, and it's just kind of me and Chuck operating on all cylinders, talking about something we're super jazzed about. So we hope you enjoy it, and my apologies for being sick in this one. It's still good.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. And that makes this Stuff You Should Know.
That's right. How are you, sir? Besides a little under the weather.
Other than that, I'm fine. I've got that, you remember in the Happiness audiobook, we talked to a guy, David Pierce, the transhumanist.
Yeah.
About separating nociception, pain, like the physical experience of pain.
Yeah.
From suffering, like just getting rid of suffering.
Right.
Like, I've reached that point in being sick where, like, I see how intertwined the two are. Like, I just keep saying, like, woe is me. Like, yeah. I am suffering. It's pretty bad.
So do you feel bad, like, in a flu sense, or is it just the head full of stuff that makes it unbearable?
No, luckily I don't have any flu symptoms.
Yeah, because that's what puts me under is when you literally feel those aches.
And your skin is really sensitive.
But a bad cold was just what I had before you. We're taking turns.
I don't know if I got it from you or not.
I doubt
it. Air travel often will do that, so yeah.
I got mine after air travel too. Jerk.
Stupid air travel. It's 2012. You know, you don't. Can we do better with the recirculated air on a plane? Maybe?
Yeah, just like surely you can crack a window a little bit or something, right? Get some fresh air in there.
There's got to be something.
All right.
So, I guess we should do this one.
Yes.
We're stalling.
No, we're not. You know why we're stalling?
What?
Because we got all the time in the world, man. Slow down.
That's what I was saying.
Oh, yeah, and I'm just reiterating.
Well, thank you.
There's no hurry. There's no hurry, Josh.
Well, let's just sit here for a little while.
We're in the foundation of the long now.
You're misreading. It's the long now foundation.
I like the foundation of the long now.
No, it's just
you know
the
why? Because it's
now.
Longer.
Foundation. Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's a couple extra words there.
Named by Brian Eno.
Yeah, the great musical composer, father maybe of techno.
Producer.
I think he's called a rock musician in this article.
Well, the guy, I watched a SETI talk from Alexander Rose, who you said is the project manager.
Uh-huh, of the Long Now Foundation's Clock of the Long Now project.
Which we're going to talk about. And when he was doing his presentation, he mentioned Brian Eno, and he said, who is an ambient music guy.
Is that what he called him?
Yeah. I was like, dude, that's Brian Eno. Come on.
What did he write? What was his album, Music for Spaceports?
Something like that. That was a solo thing after Roxy Music.
Yeah. No, wait, Brian Eno was in Roxy Music?
Yeah.
I know Brian Ferry was.
They were. And they famously butted heads. And
don't
so
they always?
Brian Eno left, I think, after one album, did solo work until he hooked up with U2 and the Talking Heads and as a Uber producer.
Cool.
Man.
Way to go, Chuck.
Thanks.
That was a great explanation of Mr. Brian Eno.
Of the ambient music guy.
Right. But yeah, you're right. He's the one who coined the name, the long now. And this whole foundation, this group of people, the Long Now Foundation, or the Foundation of the Long Now, are dedicated to forcing, hoisting upon humanity, like you were saying, like just the idea of slowing down, of taking a longer view of everything, the Long Now.
Yeah, and I think the way they put it was to try and think in the terms of if you live to be 1,000 years old.
Right.
So long-term thinking for the world is better than short-term thinking. Although I would argue you need both. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because it's like, because we don't exactly when should I get out of the way of this speeding car?
Yeah, we don't live to be 1,000. Fact is. But I do like the spirit behind it.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Would you want to live to be 1,000 years old?
If we aged like normally and would be like decrepit.
Right, you don't turn into like the dungeon master from the cartoon.
You mean if it was like 1,000 years old would be the equivalent of like 100?
Sure.
Heck yeah.
Would you really?
Yeah, why not?
Well, I can think of a lot of reasons why not.
Name one.
Boredom.
You'd be worried about boredom?
Yeah.
Wow.
Boredom. I mean, think about all the stuff you can do in a century. Now multiply that by 10.
I know.
There's
like
a finite
amount of
stuff to do on this planet.
I
think everybody would end up with huge, massive drug problems by age 400.
You might be right.
Yeah.
But hey, a 400-year-old should be able to handle his H.
So, okay, despite how you feel about living to 1,000, Long Now Foundation is, they're kind of into that way of thinking. Like you said, that long-term thinking can lead to short-term gain. And a good example of this is climate change, right?
Sure, yeah.
So, I think one of the people who are on the side of, or who are in favor of taking great action against climate change, would say that if we can take steps now, if we can think further out, then, you know, we'd be able to mitigate this.
Yeah.
But we're not. We're thinking about very immediate concerns, which some are reasonable, like economic concerns, that kind of thing.
Yeah, not poo-pooing it, but it's just two schools of thought.
Exactly. So you can kind of understand where the Long Now Foundation would side or sit on that debate. But what they figured out is that we humans, to think like this, we need something to lead our minds in that direction. Because just saying, like, man, what's it going to be like 10,000 years from now?
Right.
It's like, who cares? You know?
I'm
thinking about food. Like, I am, literally, right now. I just posed the question, and I'm thinking about food already.
Right. Which is not long-term.
Right. But if there were, say, like, a 200-foot clock in front of me that I knew was designed to tick off 10,000 years, I might take a much longer view of things.
A beacon, if you will.
A beacon, indeed. So the Long Now Foundation has undertaken its flagship project, and there's a bunch of other projects, too.
Yeah, I saw that.
Called the Clock of the Long Now, a.k.a. the 10,000-year clock.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty awesome.
I can tell you're a fan.
Well, if for no other reason than to get attention for their foundation and their school of thought, you know.
Right, and that's the whole point.
Yeah.
Like, it's gotten some pretty good attention. I think a lot of people have heard of the 10,000-year clock already. But it's actually being created. One's already done.
Yeah.
A tabletop version.
Yeah, tabletop meaning 8 feet. But
right.
Yeah.
The prototype.
Yeah.
And the whole thing was proposed by a guy named Danny Hillis. Back in 1995, wrote in a Wired magazine scenarios article the idea for this, the concept behind it.
Yeah.
And there's become this kind of rallying cry that he wants a cuckoo to come out every millennium. Everybody
right.
that shows up in every article I've read on it.
That's what they say.
That's his thing. Like, he wants a cuckoo to come out in the millennium. What's crazy is I don't see anywhere in here that there actually will be a cuckoo.
Yeah, I didn't see that either.
No, so poor Danny Hillis will have to wait. But he's the guy behind the Long Now Foundation, right?
Yeah, the first thing that I notice when I look at any of the writings about them and the Long Now clock is the zero that they just placed in front of the current year. So in 1995, when he wrote that article, he proposed, you know, not that they actually change it, but the way they look at things is 01995. And just seeing a date written in that way kind of makes me breathe a little relief, because all of a sudden 2012 doesn't look like the future. 0212 looks like, oh, well, we got a long way to go.
Like we're backwater yokels time-wise.
Yeah, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because I think they said we've been around, like civilization's been around for 10,000 years or so. So essentially this clock would represent our entire past.
Well, yeah.
Moving forward.
Yeah, it would place us directly in the middle of
yeah,
the two.
Which I love.
So, which I was curious about why they're not starting over then. Why not start a 0 year
zero.
When that clock starts?
You want to name it a Clark,
it's
don't
a
you?
Clark. It's a millennium
it's a
Clark.
Year Clark.
Yeah.
Maybe because they don't want to disrespect, you know, time served.
Yeah.
If you will.
But also, so what they've come up with is a clock then that will run until the year 12,015,
yeah,
depending on how fast they can get this thing built.
Yeah.
But that's their idea, is to come up with a 10,000-year clock, a clock that will run without human intervention.
Yeah.
For 10,000 years. One that can be easily understood by anybody. Which I think that they could have done something slightly different with the design. Like, my eyes cross when I look at, like, the
clock dial
face. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm living in 0212.
Agreed.
But there's some challenges to all this, right? Like, humans haven't really made too many things, that have lasted 10,000 years yet.
Yeah.
Why should this be any different?
Well, you outlined a couple of the base, I think they have the five basic principles they were aiming for. And you outlined a couple of them there. To work relatively free of regular maintenance was one.
Right.
Simple enough to maintain that if all of a sudden we go into some post-apocalyptic world where there's no technology, we could still maintain it.
Right. They were saying they estimate it couldn't go back prior to the Bronze Age. But as
okay,
long as we have Bronze Age technology,
boy,
which began in 3500 BC,
yeah,
and the hallmark of the Bronze Age is metallurgy and
black magic
and metal ore, separating ores from metal and metal alloys.
Okay. Well, if we're sent back beyond the Bronze Age, then this clock's not going to matter very much.
No.
You know what I'm saying? A close inspection of the operational principles should reveal the principles behind its operation. It's a little bit of wordplay there.
That sounds like Danny Hillis.
And then, what else? No matter when someone comes upon it, it should be able to be improved upon. And finally, it should be able to be constructed small enough to fit on a table. That's with the prototype. So, success.
Yeah, success. And then for the rest of them, they're kind of abandoning that. Because, like we said, this thing's going to be, the one that's being constructed right now is going to be 200 feet tall.
Yes.
But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Powering such a clock, there's, if you're looking at 10,000 years, I think it seems kind of likely that civilization will suffer at least one collapse.
Sure.
If not several. And we have no idea how far back humans will be set. Hopefully not before the Bronze Age. But,
right.
So this clock needs to somehow gain power from the environment. And Danny Hillis came up with a bunch of different ideas, right? Like atomic power.
What's yeah, most
the problem
of them.
With
that? That's poor manageability and transparency.
Yeah.
Most of these are scalability.
Yeah.
Like, they may have been good ideas, but they're just, what, too large to fit their needs?
Either that, they're too big, or they're already, like, they're perfect for this clock, but you can't
gotcha.
Use that to power maybe if something's added on that requires more power.
Right.
TS, you already are using all the power you can.
Or you can't scale it up and
right.
it wouldn't work the same. Maybe
exactly.
Okay. So that would be chemical, pre-stored potential, geothermal, tidal gravitational changes, and seismic and plate tectonics. So those all had poor scalability.
Right.
So says Hillis.
you can't use pressure change because you would need like a bellows or a seal. You want this thing to be as simple as possible.
Yeah.
Because as any engineer knows, the more moving parts you have, the more parts you have that can break down.
Sure.
And the flow of water, that's a good one, right? There should be water on the planet for 10,000 years. Sorry, you're exposing the clock to water. So inherently, water is a self-defeating energy source.
Same with wind.
Yeah.
Any kind of exposure to weather, that's why this thing is buried inside of a mountain.
Right. So what did he come up with? He came up with two ideas to power this.
Humans.
That's one.
Yeah, human winding.
That's one.
A novel idea.
The other is temperature change.
That's right.
But yeah, he said his favorite was human winding because it fosters responsibility for the clock.
Yeah, which is a great idea, I think.
Because ultimately, the clock is for humans, even though it's sequestered in a mountain and it can run by itself for 10,000 years if no human ever lays eyes on it.
Right.
It's for humans.
And we'll explain all that. If it sounds like we're talking out of both sides of our mouths, we'll explain all that by saying, doesn't need humans, yet it does need humans. I bet people can't wait. I can just feel the tension.
I know. The hairs on the back of their necks are bristling.
All right. So for the prototype, it's sort of like an old school clock in a way. They use two helical weights, similar to the weight gravity systems, just like clock towers, old clock towers.
Right.
And they drive the energy going up and down on these tubes, which will drive the pendulum, right?
Yeah. And ultimately, the prototype... The drive assembly, I guess you'd call it, it served its purpose. It was a prototype in that it said, okay, we need to do something different.
Right.
And they have. But for the prototype, yeah, there's helical weights, which I'm not familiar with. Are you?
No.
Okay. But the prototype also still had like a solar synchronizer, which we'll talk about later, and a pendulum, which we'll also get a little more into. But the pendulum is kind of key to keeping the time.
Maybe we should do that now.
You want to?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so back in the 1600s, people were trying to figure out how to keep time better than they had been, more accurately. And somebody, a Dutch astronomer, back in that day, the best astronomers were Dutch.
Christian Huygens.
He said, hey, why don't you try using a pendulum? Because a pendulum has a pretty cool property in that the only two things that affect the swing of a pendulum, nothing else affects the swing of a pendulum, not changes in temperature, not humidity, not anything else, except the force of gravity and the length of the pendulum.
I didn't know this.
Well, I didn't either. If you take a pendulum and put it just about anywhere on Earth, you're going to find that the gravitational field is so close to the same that a pendulum will swing the same way anywhere on Earth.
At the same rate, too, right?
Right. So what affects that rate, the period, which is the amount of time it takes for a pendulum to swing all the way from one side to the other.
Right.
So not just one side, it's both. That's
right.
a pendulum's period. So really, the only thing that affects it is the length of the pendulum. Right? The shorter the pendulum, the faster they go. The longer the pendulum, usually, the longer it takes.
And once you get a pendulum going, which doesn't require a lot, it'll keep going.
Yes. It takes a very small amount of energy input to keep it going, right?
Yeah, which is perfect for something like a 10,000-year clock.
Right. So if you put a pendulum and attach it to something called an escapement, right?
Yeah, this is the part I got confused on.
Okay, well, check this out. So you have a pendulum, and you figured out the exact length you need for a pendulum's period to take 1 second.
To tick off 1 second on a second hand.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So you can attach the pendulum to this thing called an escapement. An escapement is just like a wheel with some gears to it, right?
Okay.
And these gears are attached to the second hand.
Okay.
Okay? And the escapement's always wanting to go forward. But it's being held in place by the pendulum,
okay,
which is attached to an anchor. But we'll just call it the pendulum, right?
Okay.
So as the pendulum swings one way, the escapement gear is being held in place.
Mm-hmm.
And when it swings the other way, which is the end of a second, the pendulum opens up, allowing the escapement gear to tick forward one tooth, thus moving the second hand forward one movement in a second.
Oh.
So that's how you do it. And if you're very, very clever, you can design the escapement gear so that as it moves, as it escapes, it also nudges that anchor that's attached to the pendulum, transferring energy back to the pendulum to keep it swinging.
And that's basic, the basics of a clock.
Of a pendulum,
a mechanical clock.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what they use for the 10,000-year clock, too, very smartly and appropriately, too.
Yeah, I love how when they do design something to work 10,000 years, they go back to Bronze Age and, well, this wasn't Bronze Age, but a lot of just old mechanical technology.
Well, yeah. I mean, we've advanced in a lot. I mean, if you're going to make a digital clock, yeah, we know what we're doing, but
right.
How are you going to power it? You want to just use some really old, perfect technology.
Exactly. That's called long thinking, Josh.
Right.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So we've got winding and temperature changes, differences in temperature changes that are powering this clock now, right?
That's right.
And then those are the two principles that are powering the clock. And there are different parts of the clock that need to be powered. Like your favorite, the Geneva wheels, right?
Yeah, Geneva wheel sounds intimidating. A Geneva drive until you look it up on YouTube and see what it is. And it's really just... And it can come in all kinds of shapes. And in this case, it's sort of the shape of a star.
Uh-huh.
And it's, imagine each point of a star has a notch cut in it. And sitting underneath that is a wheel, a drive wheel that spins with a peg coming out of it.
Right.
And it slips into the little slot on the star, advancing it one little click, keeps turning and spins out of it. And then by the time it comes back around, it slips back into the next one. So it's just a slow ticking around in a circle.
Right. And so there's, I think, 20 of these for the big clock, but they're designed with a bunch of holes in them, the pins and holes system, basically.
Yeah.
Which essentially is making a mechanical Babbage difference engine.
Yeah.
Like an early computer, like a punch hole computer.
Yeah.
Right?
That's what they use before calculators. They use mechanical summers or adders.
Right. And this is but it's adding in binary, ones and zeros.
Yeah.
So it's carrying out digital calculations through mechanical means, which is
pretty
astounding.
Cool. Yeah.
And they're using this astounding technology
right.
to power basically what, in this article that we were reading, it's the world's slowest computer.
Yeah.
And that computer is being used to calculate an algorithm that will produce a different chime using 10 different chimes or two bells.
Yeah.
So that this thing supposedly will never make the same chime twice.
Yeah, I think the algorithm maxes out at 3.5 million chimes, of course, designed, composed by Brian Eno.
Right.
The ambient music guy.
Right.
And that doesn't have anything to do with the powering of the clock. That's just the chimes.
No, but the dirty secret of the Long Now Foundation is that 3.5 million different possible chime tones.
Yeah.
Or combinations is about 90,000 days short of 10,000 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's 90,000 days in years?
I don't know.
Do you do you have a binary adder?
365. We need some Geneva wheels in here, stat.
Well, they're not telling anyone that, though, obviously.
No, they did, actually.
Oh, did they?
Wired. Yeah, they're like, you know, this thing's not going to chime every day, so I'm sure it'll be fine.
Okay.
But basically, no one's speaking to Brian Eno right now.
He's been demoted to ambient music guy from legendary producer.
Yeah.
So the prototype, that's the prototype. It's 8 feet tall, roughly 8.5. It is at the Science Museum in London. You can go see it there.
Yep.
And it first started ticking on December 31st, 1999, or 01999.
Yeah.
If you're a Long Nower.
And it worked. It gonged twice at the turn of the millennium to indicate that two millenniums are now passed, which is funny because technically the millennium didn't start until 2001.
That's true.
But they don't care.
They don't care about a lot of stuff, as I'm finding out. So let's talk about the real deal. When this article was written, the real deal was just proposed and it was going to be about 60 feet tall. That was 2 years ago.
Well, that one is the one in Nevada. I think that's still going to be 60 feet tall.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they just decided to start on the Texas one first?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Because Bezos was like, hey, here's $42 million. Can we get started?
Well, go ahead. Spill the beans there.
I just did.
Jeffrey Bezos, founder of Amazon.com, is heavily involved in this to the tune of money and it being built on a mountain, inside a mountain in West Texas on his property.
Yeah.
So he owns it, sort of.
Kind of. I get the impression that, yes, he definitely has, this project is his, but it's one of many that are going to be built around the world.
Like, yeah,
they
that's
got approval to build one in a Smithsonian, just this past year.
Oh, cool.
Also, Bezos, by the way, he said that the two are unrelated. It's just a cool coincidence or whatever. But he's also building a spaceport by the mountain, too.
And he says that's unrelated to the clock.
Yeah. He just said, hey, that's, why not? There's a spaceport. There's going to be a 10,000-year clock. We'll see what happens. But if you want to see, he's funding this this space program called Blue Origin.
Uh-huh.
And you know how, like, in the 50s, like, science fiction rockets would, like, land just going straight up and straight down?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That's what his rockets do. And there's, you can see video of it. It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Really?
That I'm like, is this real? Like, we're pretty good at After Effects these days.
Right.
It's gotta be.
I think it's real.
Yeah. So
when you got that kind of dough, you can make it happen.
BlueOrigin.com.
I will look that up, sir.
So like you said, Bezos is, or the one in Texas, I guess is what you should call it. The one that's under construction is going to be about 200 feet tall.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's out in the middle of nowhere, very purposefully.
Yeah, I think it's hours from the nearest airport. It requires a full day's hike to reach the mouth of the cave opening.
Yeah.
Which is like a steel door.
And it's a mountain rising up from the desert, so you have a 1,500-foot climb just to get to the steel door, the first door.
Yeah, so vandals, not only will you be trespassing, but you need to be a mountaineer if you want to go mess with this thing.
Yeah.
Which we don't encourage anyone to do.
But they have, the first door is going to be jade, which is pretty cool. It's going to be hidden behind the rock face. So like you have to, I guess you could stumble upon it. I think that's part of the idea.
The fun.
Yeah. But you will know when you do stumble upon it that there's something very cool there because there's going to be a carved jade door in the rock face.
Well, they're going to open it up when they finish, they said.
They are, but I'm saying like if the location or the idea or anything having to do with the clock, it'll still be there.
Sure.
And people can find it accidentally.
Yeah, what really bothers me about this is I'm not going to know the result.
Well,
you know?
If you lived to 1,000, maybe you would.
But I can't live to 10,000.
No.
Regardless.
But does that bother you?
Yeah, like I want to know how this ends. I want to know if in 10,000 years if it's still running.
Well, what happens if okay, so just the clock.
Yeah,
just so you don't care what happens like 10,500 years from now.
No, just the clock.
Okay.
So if you want to access this thing, you go through those two doors. It's in complete darkness. It's not all lit up, which is kind of cool.
Right.
Because I guess any kind, and they don't want any kind of electricity to be needed.
No.
Obviously, while they're building it, they're using stuff, but...
For a visitor like, later on.
Yeah, exactly.
A post-Bronze Age visitor.
It's going to be housed in a 500-foot tall tunnel, about 12 feet in diameter.
Yeah, a vertical tunnel.
Yeah.
That's like a shaft. Basically, it's a 12-foot diameter shaft that's 500 feet tall.
Very tall. And it's got a very precise rock staircase that was carved with a robot slicing machine.
Did you see video of that thing?
Yeah.
It was awesome.
And it starts at the top, which is cool. Basically, it starts at the top with this just big hunk of rock and just cuts in a circle down, 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 one stair at a time.
Like the golden ratio, kind of. Like a Nautilus.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
And so that's how you're going to access the gears. So let's go ahead and get to that. Let's go ahead and get to the counterweights, at least.
Well, that's the first thing you would kind of come upon if you walked in on this thing and it's completed. And the counterweights are made up of stone disks, each about the size of a car, each weighing about 10,000 pounds.
Wow.
And we said that winding and differences in temperature change are the principles that provide energy for this clock.
Yeah.
But the weights are what keep it running.
Right.
And when you come upon the weights, you're going to come upon a platform, and you know those like old, those old movies or whatever, where there's you know slaves or somebody on a ship, and they're having to like crank a wheel. Like there's three guys like all moving in the same direction, and each one has like a pole that he's pushing.
Yeah, like a horizontal wheel.
Right.
Yeah.
They're going to have one of those for visitors to crank, and that will raise these enormous counterweights. And once they're fully raised, they'll have enough stored potential energy to power the clock for about a century without a single dash of sunlight or another human visitor.
So that's essentially winding the clock. I think they said two or three people it takes to do this.
Yeah.
And it's a, what's it called, a capstan?
I think that that is what it's called. It's called a capstan, right?
Yeah.
That's the horizontal wheel that's... Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. Like, it requires human intervention. But as we said, and let's go ahead and spill the beans how that works. If no one came around ever, it would still run because of differences in it collects sun's rays.
Right.
Through a prism that sticks out at the top.
Yeah, through a sapphire cupola.
I bet that looks nice.
Yeah.
And that's the only part that's visible from outside, they said.
Yes.
And it collects the sun's rays and then channels them down through metal rods. And the difference in the, was it the interior cave temperature and the temperature that it collects?
Between day and night. The changes in day and night, which is pretty ingenious because if you think about what there probably still will be over 10,000 years, there probably will still be day and night.
Yes.
And that's ultimately what powers this.
Well,
with no human intervention.
Yeah, exactly. This dude, though, the Alexander, what was his name? Rose?
I think so.
He said that what they had to figure out, there's something called the equation of time, and it's not constant. Like, the Earth is slowing its rotation by about a second every couple of hundred years, and all this stuff sounds like, yeah, big deal. But when you look on a 10,000-year timeline, it is a big deal.
Yeah.
So the Earth is slowing by about a second every couple of hundred years. It's also processing on its pole every 26,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to take that into account. And then climate change, it's going to, if poles continue to melt, water's going to be pushed out. It's going to rotate even slower. So what they figured out, there was a variance. Well, normally there's a variance of about 10 or 15 minutes throughout the course of a year from where the sun should be.
Yeah.
And they designed this thing to self-correct to still be able to pick up the sun's rays.
Yeah, pretty ingeniously.
But they needed to do it on a 10,000-year scale, so they basically formulated this massive equation, and they figured out how time would evolve over 10,000 years according to all these variables, and they found out it is a plus or minus, and this is worst-case scenario with climate change, of 23 days from where they think the sun should be over 10,000 years.
Right, which means that the clock is way off. by the end of the 10,000 years.
Well, but they accounted for that with this equation.
They did. And the way that they accounted for it, though, also is through the solar synchronizer.
Right.
So every sunny day that at noontime, the sun will hit that prism, will heat up this little rod that sends a signal to the clock's inner workings, so the smart part of the clock that keeps time all the time, no matter what.
Right.
And says, hey, it's solar noon.
Right.
And the clock readjusts itself. So the most it's ever going to get off is, say, you know, however many days or maybe a couple of centuries without sunlight, if there's some sort of horrible nuclear winter or whatever.
Right.
But let's say a couple hundred years without sunlight. The next time there's sunlight, it'll say, oh, it's noon, and the clock will just readjust itself.
You kind of wake back up.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
But it'll go back to, oh, okay, it's noon now. No matter how far it drifted,
right,
it will now know it's noon, solar noon.
So awesome.
It is very awesome. And the differences in temperature also, it's called the thermoelectric effect.
Yeah.
The electrons, if you have a thermoelectric device, electrons will go from the hot side to the cold side. And you know as well as I do that the flow of electrons equals electricity.
That's right.
So that will keep things in check as well. That will keep the inner workings powered too.
Boy, they thought of everything.
They did. And they also thought of ways to store energy or to keep from using energy. Saving energy is another way to put it.
Well, yeah. I mean, over time, I think they said that if the difference in temperature is great enough, it will just store that temperature. And over a timeline, if that keeps happening, it won't even have to, you know, stop and catch up. It'll just start operating fully mechanically by itself.
Right. So here in the
like
order...
self-winding, essentially.
Exactly. So in the order of preference or of importance, this solar energy or the diurnal temperature change energy goes from the inner workings of the clock.
Yes.
Spills over to the weights.
Yes.
And then if the weights are wound, then you will have the Geneva drive
operating, right? That's right.
So it goes basically like the clock knowing the correct time, the clock operating and showing the correct time or whatever information that's supposed to, and then the clock making sounds. Those are the
chimes.
Levels of importance.
Oh, right. As far as
energy distribution goes.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because the chimes, they got to come last.
They do.
It's nice and all, but...
They're meant for human consumption, but if enough of that diurnal temperature difference energy spills over to the weights, then the clock will ostensibly chime when nobody's there.
That's pretty cool.
That's very cool.
And next to his little rocket station, right?
Yeah.
He's got it all figured out.
Yeah.
So while we mentioned the Geneva gears on the main, the 200-foot one they're building, these are about 8 feet in diameter, each one, weighing about 1,000 pounds.
There's 20 of them, right?
Yeah. And it's pretty remarkable. I mean, if you ever been inside a clock tower and seen that, it's like, imagine that times 20.
And remember, the Geneva drive system is the mechanical computer that's calculating the algorithm to play the chimes. It's the whole reason it's there.
That's right.
And it's being powered by winding or the weights, winding the weights.
Yes.
Okay.
So if you keep climbing up in this thing, you will get to the primary chamber, and that is where you finally see the face of the clock, which is the most important thing if you're building a clock.
It's also the most baffling thing.
Yeah. I mean, the face of this clock is, or if it's anything like the prototype, it's not like any clock I've ever seen.
It's very awesome. Like, you can clearly say, oh, I see the century and I see the millennium. Maybe even the year, but like when I get to the star field, I imagine like, so the star field's being displayed.
Yeah.
I get that. I think that that means that if it were nighttime and you could see the star field and you went outside and looked up,
you could know what time
you would see the same stars, right?
Right.
Okay. But the horizons are what's throwing me off the most. The REET, R-E-T-E.
Yeah.
It shows horizons. I don't understand
that.
What that means or what you're going to get from that. Fortunately, and I haven't seen it, but supposedly there's going to be a manual or some sort of explanation.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll have it some sort of, if once they open it up for people to come visit, there'll be some like little button you push and it'll be Morgan Freeman's voice explaining how it works or what the horizon means.
Right. If you want to know the time of day, though, you have to ask the clock, Chuck.
I thought this was one of the coolest parts of this whole deal.
Yeah.
Because they built it to operate at its most frugal over the years, obviously.
Right.
And one thing that you don't need is a current readout if no one's there to read it.
Right.
And so they says, well, why don't you ask the clock, like you said? So whatever time you see when you approach the clock is the last time that it read when someone wound not the clock itself, but the clock's face, right?
The display.
The clock's display.
So there's two ways to wind it. The capstan that raises the weights.
Yeah.
And then there's a little hand wheel that just one single person can do to wind the clock's display.
And it'll correct itself and say, it's now, you know, whatever time it is.
Yeah.
And here's the horizon, which Josh doesn't get.
Right.
And here's where the moon and sun phases are. And
yeah.
Here's what year it is with a zero in the front of it.
It's pretty cool.
It's very cool.
So the clock always knows what time it is. It's just not necessarily displaying it.
Yeah, it's just not going to tell you.
Until it's asked.
Pretty cool.
So, Chuck, there's some pretty obvious reasons to choose the inside of a mountain to put this clock in. Earthquake protection, nuclear bomb protection. Mountains
elements.
They're long-lasting.
Yeah.
But there's other reasons that they chose the interior of a mountain as well. Like the differences in temperature between seasons and day within the mountain are very minimal. Which means that you're not going to have a freeze-thaw cycle,
right.
Which is apparently very corrosive.
Yeah, but it's great enough to where you're going to get energy out of it.
Right, especially at the top.
Yeah.
So remember, like, there's the mountain top that from the entrance, the bottom of the clock to the top is 500 feet, but the clock's only 200 feet.
Yeah.
So that extra 300 feet is above there is where the temperature differences will really be noticeable.
Right. They picked a very good place, and also the one in Nevada has got similar conditions, I think.
Yeah.
So, which is why they picked that.
High, dry desert.
And then the parts. This is remarkable to me. If you're going to construct something that lasts for 10,000 years, you're not going to want to throw a bunch of 30-weight oil in there.
Right.
Because oil has the potential to fail and leak, and oil will attract dirt. Like crazy.
Yep. And little hairs and like fuzzies from your sweater.
Little pieces of grit over 10,000 years will stop any machine from running.
Right.
So what they did was they, borrowing from NASA, who originally developed ceramic bearings to use on satellites. So, because you don't want to have satellites that need oiling either.
Right.
They used ceramic, which nowadays can be harder than diamonds, ceramic bearings. Like the moving parts are ceramic.
Yeah. And remember earlier I said, like, humans haven't made too many things that have lasted 10,000 years. Ceramic potsherds are one example of something.
Boom.
We have potsherds that are, like, 17,000 years old. And that's just, like, from a pot. What they're making today should be able to last way longer.
Way longer.
And because these parts move so slowly, they don't require any lubrication. So the ceramic ball bearings are keeping the metal parts away from one another. Because if you have two like metals that are in contact and aren't moving, really, like the Millennium Dial.
Yeah.
Basically won't move the whole time you or I are alive or our children are alive.
Right.
And if you have the same kind of metal and like one gear touching the other gear, they're just going to fuse together.
You know why? Microvibration.
I did not enlighten me.
No, it's microvibration. Like it's not moving, quote unquote, but microvibration over 10,000 years will cause it to weld itself.
That's pretty cool.
And that's if it's a like metal. And if they're unlike, they will corrode over time. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's galvanic corrosion. If they're dissimilar metals, they'll just eat into each other. So either way, you don't want these metals touching one another. So the ceramic ball bearings that don't need any lubrication are perfect.
That's right. The rest of it is made from 316 stainless steel, which this Alexander guy said that'll last 10,000 years.
And even if it starts to rust, the movements of this clock, because it moves so slowly and because it's so large, the precision doesn't need to be like thousandths of an inch.
That's what's so cool.
It can be like a quarter of an inch.
Yeah. Well, that's plenty of room for rust.
Right. So if there is rust, it really doesn't matter.
And I also saw where he said in the video that all the gear teeth were cut three-dimensionally. And what that means is it uses rollers to roll the gear, so it's a rolling mechanism instead of what he called a scrubbing friction. Uh-huh. So I guess a rolling friction is much easier on the parts than scrubbing.
Nice. And I was reading a Wired article on it, and the reporter said that he came upon a Geneva wheel. Remember, they're 8 feet in diameter.
Yeah, these are.
And they had the ceramic ball bearings in it, and he could turn it very easily with just like gentle pressure from his finger.
Wow.
So they're going to be working just fine.
I want to visit this thing when it's done at least. I know I won't see the end, but I'd like to be there for the beginning.
Well, you can actually. You can go join the Long Now Foundation at longnow.org, right?
Yeah, they operate on donations. I don't think we ever even mentioned. It's a private organization.
Right.
And funded by people like Bezos.
And I think the basic membership costs like $8 a month. You probably have a pretty good idea of where your money's going.
What's their website?
Longnow.org.
Longnow.org, and then there's also now 10,000yearclock.net.
And that's Bezos's website.
Yeah, and there's not a whole lot there yet, but...
No, I mean, it just gave some overview, but... We left out this one part in the one in Texas, Bezos's Millennium Clock. There's going to be little, alcoves, different rooms.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a 1 year room, a 10 year room, 100, 1,000, and 10,000 year room. And like, they're leaving it to later civilizations to figure out what artifact to put in there.
Yeah.
But in the 1 year room, they're putting the Ori, which tracks the motion of it calculates the movement of the planets.
Right.
And it also has an animation of, I think, Voyager 2 on this grand tour of, like, some of the outer planets.
Awesome.
And that's going in the 1 year. And they're going to figure out what to put in the 10 year. So they're soliciting ideas from anybody.
I saw that. That's crazy.
If you have an idea of what should be put in the 10 year alcove.
But I guess some of that stuff would require electricity, though, right?
No, I don't think so.
In the side rooms, no?
I don't think any of it's going to.
Oh, wow.
Or if it does, it will just be a thermoelectricity.
Right.
Yeah.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So I feel like we covered that pretty well.
Yeah.
10,000-year clock.
I mean, it's way more basic than it appears, like, when you first look at it. It's like simple gears moving, pendulum swinging,
weights going up and down. It's also incredibly ingenious, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The way they put it together, it overcame problems that it may not encounter for thousands of years.
Very smart dudes and ladies.
If you want to learn more about the 10,000-year clock, you can type in 10,000-year clock in the search bar at howstuffworks.com. And that, I said search bar, so that means it's time for listener mail.
That's right, Josh. I'm going to call this The cone snail saved my life.
Yes.
Remember when we talked about the cone snail?
No.
In the Venom podcast?
No.
It wasn't Venom. What was it? It was...
Probably.
Was it just called Venom?
No, it's like, what's the most venomous animal on Earth?
There you go.
Something.
That's right. This is from David in Miami. Hey, guys. Love the show. I recently listened to the show on Venom, and you mentioned the cone snail. 5 years ago, cone snail venom saved my life. In 1994, I was diagnosed with cancer, and due to the cancer, chronic pain. After many years of failed attempts to control my pain with conventional medication, I was extremely frustrated and still suffering intolerable pain. Luckily, I found out about the ziconotide cone snail venom. Because remember, I think we talked about scorpion venom being used in cancer.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
The only problem with using the cone snail venom to control pain is that I needed an implant. It can't be taken in pill form. One needs to be implanted with a hockey puck-sized implant that slowly releases the medication into my intrathecal fluid.
What?
Which is the fluid surrounding the spinal cord. I might be pronouncing it wrong. Every 3 months, I need to go in for a refill. So using a small needle, this guy's like Iron Man.
Yeah.
The doctor refills the pump that's inside of his body with cone snail venom. It has been a godsend and greatly improved my quality of life. And some days I am completely pain-free.
That is cool.
So, David Miami, kudos to you, sir, and continued good health.
Hats off to your medical pioneering.
Absolutely.
What's old is new again.
And thank you, Cone Snail.
Yeah, thanks, Cone Snail. Let's see, if you have an email about a past episode and how it affected your life, we always want to hear that kind of thing.
Sure.
You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. That's our handle. You can join us on Facebook at facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. Also, we have a newsletter. You can go to Stuff You Should Know's Facebook page, and there's a tab to sign up for the Stuff You Should Know electronic email newsletter. It's all free.
It's over on the left side under our picture on the very bottom. You'll see SYSK newsletter.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool. It comes out, what, once a week, right?
Is it?
Something like that. It has like our links to some of our favorite articles. Just cool stuff. Link to the newest episode. It's just neat. It's one of the better things you'll get in your inbox.
Agreed.
And speaking of inboxes, you can send us a good old-fashioned email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.